Hi, Richard Feidler here. Thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. There are many, many more at abc.net.au/conversations.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, welcome to Conversations. Infectious diseases are the stuff of nightmares. All that corruption and putrefaction, and quite frankly, that's why they're so fascinating. And doctors who treat these things often feel that way too, but then they come face to face with the poor patient who's living through the experience of having one's own body become the host and factory for a nasty pathogen. Frank Bowden is a specialist in infectious diseases, the world of microscopic germs that infect us and then do their best to churn out photocopies of themselves so they can survive and propagate and latch onto the next person. He began his medical life at the old Fairfield Hospital for Infectious Diseases in Melbourne. He treated patients in the Northern Territory, and now he's the Professor of Medicine at the ANU's Medical School. Frank has seen shocking new diseases arrive on the scene, and he's been part of the medical struggle to push them back. And he's written a book full of stories of his life in the world of germs called Gone Viral, The Germs That Share Our Lives, and it is fascinating. Hello, Frank.
Hi, Richard.
Tell me about your germ-phobic childhood, please.
My dear, dear mother, who unfortunately the only thing I've ever written about her is to emphasise her germ phobia, and my sister's not very happy about that.
I know, but she loved you. Your mum loved you. That's why she was the way she was about this stuff.
She did. She certainly loved me. But my mother grew up at a time when people were really frightened of germs. If you go back to a time before antibiotics, people knew the power of the germ. And those germs were bacteria and viruses, but people didn't know exactly what they were often. They just knew that they caused serious illness. And you would, every person would have individual personal experience of people who would contract an illness, which would be simple infection, which would progress to something terrible, and they would die. There was, you know, it wouldn't matter where you were in the world. My mother grew up in Melbourne. But she had direct experience of scarlet fever, of tetanus, of rheumatic fever, of boils that would turn into something awful and lead to abscesses that needed to be drained and people losing legs. So she belonged to the generation who knew of the power of the microbe.
So this was your mum's response to microbes in your children was really quite commonplace for its time.
Well, this is where
somewhat commonplace.
Yeah, well, this is where it may not be quite right, in the sense that Mum's response was probably a little bit at the extreme end, and she was very worried about things.
And when you say a little bit at the extreme end, how did that manifest itself?
Well, things like there's part of our folklore in our family is that for one of my older brother's birthdays, he had a cold and the whole party was organised and everybody was coming around to our place. And Mum said, no, there's no cake, because if he blows the candles off on the cake, he'll spread the germs all over the cake. And my very sensible godmother, who lived across the road, said, no, Joan, you can't do that. We'll fix it. And she said, no, we can't. So her solution to the problem was, my godmother's solution to the problem was to create what I have now latterly called a condom for the cake. and she placed it over the, which is really just a piece of paper over the cake when the candles went on top. And my brother blew the cake out and everybody cheered. And then she took the condom off the cake and distributed the cake. Now, that was an extreme, I'm sure.
Can I say I'm with your mum on this? I'm sorry, if someone's got a cold and they're blowing all over a cake, I'm going to pass on that piece of cake, probably. I'm going to need a cake prophylactic of some kind, I think, to indulge myself.
All right, so maybe it wasn't so silly. But Mum would, if I handled money, if I picked up a coin, she'd say, go and wash your hands. If people gave you when I was growing up, a dollar bill, that was dirty. That was, you know, that had been through everybody's hands. She would look at, this is my, I grew up in a thinking that everybody did this, that when you went to the toilet, you laid sheet of toilet paper on the water service.
Right. And what about the toilet seat? Would you upholster
On the toilet seat would be upholstered with toilet paper. But I noticed that people do that now. You can actually get seat covers, I see, in some of the aeroplanes and places like that. But you didn't want to have a splash, which could come up and,
right,
and affect your bottom.
Right. It just reminds me of Dad's Army. Remember Dad's Army in Pike, the overgrown kind of teenager?
Yes.
His mother wouldn't let him talk on a public telephone.
That's right. Oh, public telephones were terrible.
Right out?
Oh, no. You'd have to have some Dettol with you if you were going to talk on the public telephone.
But people still got sick nonetheless. Your dad got... There have been several great big viral outbreaks, flu outbreaks in the 20th century. The worst one, I think, was the Spanish flu, wasn't it?
That's right.
At the end of the First World War, which killed more people than died in combat in the First World War. One was an outbreak of Hong Kong flu in the late 1960s. Now, your dad got that, didn't he? What can you remember of what happened to your dad when he contracted Hong Kong flu?
Yeah, well, I remember this saved my father's life. Well, not sure whether it saved his life in the sense, but it prolonged his life because he came down with the flu, came home from work, walked in the door and then suddenly became unwell. Was like on and off, which is...
In minutes. In,
yeah, within minutes you know this. And I've only ever had confirmed flu twice. And the first time it was exactly the same. You feel well and then suddenly, the next moment, you feel crook.
How does that virus do that?
It's obviously releasing this what we call cytokines, which are tiny little chemicals which make you feel sick, and it does this suddenly and it comes out of the blue, 1 minute well, next minute sick, high temperature. Although usually when you have a high temperature, the first thing you notice is probably that you feel cold. So the chill is the first thing that you notice, even though at that time you've probably got a temperature. So this happened to Dad. He got home. Next minute he's in bed, shivering and shaking, and the next day in the paper the Hong Kong flu is announced. And he spent a long time in bed. And, in fact, those were the days when hospitalisation was, you know, people weren't as quick to go to hospital. And our GP came around and saw him and, of course, gave him some penicillin, which was the standard treatment for everything.
It did nothing.
Which would have done nothing in the first instance. I mean, people who get the flu are at very high risk of getting secondary infections with bacteria, which is the main killer over time. But in the early stages, there's no point in giving people penicillin for influenza. But the good thing about it was that he was so sick and his sensible GP said, you're going to have to stop smoking. And a man who smoked 40 cigarettes a day since he was 16, he was obviously on the road to great trouble in his 40s. And he stopped cold turkey and he lived to be 83, which was good.
Got off the gaspers that way.
Exactly.
You know, as men, well, I'm speaking myself, men often say when we've got a bad cold, we've got the flu.
Yes.
And then you get the flu and you go, oh, my God, this is so much worse than a bad cold. And all you can do is really lie there and whimper, really, with this awful headache and the cough and the shakes and everything else. It's truly dreadful having the flu. Viruses are funny things, aren't they? I want to ask you a bit about the nature of the flu virus. It might be an odd question, but why do viruses make us sick? Isn't it in the virus's interest that it invades our system, it churns out photocopies of itself, and we can be out and about feeling fine in the world so we can spread the virus?
Yes. We evolved with pathogens. Human beings are a very complicated structure. Viruses are a very simple structure, and they came before us. Viruses and bacteria precede us. In fact, we are composed of bacteria. Our cells, in every human cell, there's a thing called a mitochondria, or mitochondrion, the plural is mitochondria, and those mitochondria are thought to be the remnants of bacteria, which originally moved into our cells and we adopted them and used the machinery of the bacterium.
So you're saying we're related in some ways
to
viruses? I mean, to bacteria.
To bacteria, yes.
But what about viruses?
Well, viruses are also in our system. That the viruses, which are just pieces of either DNA or RNA, all of us carry within our genetic material, within our DNA, we've got sequences of virus, which don't do anything.
DNA.
That would be one way to describe it. It's not strictly junk DNA, but it's probably not doing anything. Many of these are called retroviruses, endogenous retroviruses, which people have. And some people are arguing that they're responsible for some diseases and some autoimmune diseases. There's no proof of that, but it's a very interesting area for speculation. But mostly, they do nothing. So we've been living with germs, we've been living with viruses, bacteria, since we became human.
Viruses, when I was taught biology in high school in the late 1970s, this is going back a bit, as I can best recall it, I was always told about viruses that they were, that science hadn't figured out whether they were living things or not. What's the thinking now? Are viruses alive, or are they just like a set of bad instructions, bad code?
Define alive. They
wiggle, moving, something that wiggles.
Okay, something that wiggles is a bacterium.
Right.
So bacteria, parasites, they can live by themselves. So on this desk right now, there's possibly some living bacteria.
Oh, it's the ABC. There's tons of it. There's tons.
But the virus, if the virus was there, it could still be able to be transferred from the table to me, but it's much less likely. Usually the viruses break down quite quickly, but some of them are covered and coated and they're protected from the environment, so they're protected from the cold and the heat and from water. But they sit there and they can't do anything by themselves. They can't multiply by themselves. So if one virus lands on the table, it sits there as one virus forever until its coat breaks down and then it's no longer, and the DNA breaks down or the RNA breaks
down. So it's like a computer program that needs a computer?
Correct. Yep. That's a lovely analogy for it, that it's an instruction set that has to be inserted into the drive and then turned using the computer. It doesn't matter what computer you use. Doesn't matter whether it's a human or a dog or a bird. It needs a cell, or it needs a living organism. It needs a complex organism to take it up, and then the virus uses the machinery of the cell to reproduce itself.
Yes, this is where they struck me as evil. I know that's kind of wrong and childish, but there's something, if they've invaded my cells without my consent, and it's sort of taking over saying, right, everyone out, I'm going to use this as a self-replication factory. That's what they do, isn't it? They just go chunk, 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 and make out more and more copies of them.
Yeah, and the most sensible thing for a virus to do from an evolutionary point of view is not to cause serious illness. So if you have a virus which kills everybody who it infects, then that's a dead end for the virus. You need a virus that causes illness which is mild and, best of all, asymptomatic, which means that it doesn't cause a symptom in the person, but they become infected and they can spread it to the next person.
So this is why the cold is still with us.
Correct.
This is because it doesn't kill us. Yep. It almost never kills human beings, and we can walk around with it and still keep working. That's why the cold is so successful.
That's right.
I remember this because there was a huge panic. When I was living in England in the early 90s, there was a panic about the Ebola virus. Remember that? The panic. It was going to infect us and we'd all be sort of, you know, we'd be... have our flesh eaten and turn into kind of the legions of the undead. But then it was sort of pointed out that those kind of germs that attack the body so violently are never successful for very long because they kill us.
That's right. They'll be successful for a period of time, and there's a natural tendency for these infections to become less severe over time. If you go back to when syphilis first entered the human population or the developed world, so within historical times, syphilis was a disease which was so virulent. People would get it and die quickly. And then over time, either the pathogen became less virulent or human beings, the humans who were very susceptible died, and the ones who were naturally resistant and where it caused less serious disease survived and continued the transmission of the disease. Syphilis is still all around the world. It's everywhere. But most people who get it don't know they've got it. Bacterium gets into you, lives there for a long, long time, and then reproduces and transmits to the next person, and you don't know it. So it's quietly, happily living with us.
Flu breaks out all the time, every winter in westernised societies like ours. Why is there such concern, worry, and war rooms set up in case there's an outbreak of some kind of avian flu? Why would that be any worse than the normal flu we get?
An avian flu, a bird flu epidemic, turning into a pandemic across the whole world is everybody's nightmare. The WHO were thinking that this would be the next thing that would happen. The swine flu arrived, but people thought it was going to be bird flu. Swine flu luckily doesn't have a very high death... Or sorry, the swine flu that we saw in 2009 doesn't have a very high death rate. But bird flu, which essentially... is a disease that only stays within the birds. So it's transmissible from bird to bird, and only very rarely moves from bird to human. And you have to be really close to the bird. So people who are...
live next to chickens.
Particularly. And this is a major change in human activity over the last 10, 15 years, has been the worldwide demand for chicken. We love chicken, and now that in particularly in Asia, where people have got more money, more ability to get meat, and chicken is the easiest meat to breed. The closeness of the humans and the birds has meant that we now have much more opportunity for the virus to come in contact with humans. Now the nightmare scenario is where at the same time as the bird flu is circulating amongst the birds, you've got a human flu circulating, so there's an epidemic of a human flu going on, and then the flu viruses combine. They recombine together.
They have sex.
They do. I know young people would have no problems about the fact that viruses have sex with each other, but it's true, they do. When they do... something new can be created, which was much more than the normal mutation that occurs every day. Flu viruses are always changing, but they change slowly and gently, and our immune systems keep up with them to a certain extent.
So is the danger because, not so much because a bird flu virus would create much more deadly symptoms, it's just that it would be more widespread? Is that
no,
what you're saying?
No, no. It's because what happens is that the bird flu, if it gets into humans, kills most of them. Now, at its worst, the pandemic flu of 1918, the Spanish flu, which killed tens, if not hundreds of millions of people, only had a death rate, a maximum death rate of 4%, and it may have been even slightly smaller. But because it affected everybody, 4% of the population was an enormous number. So that's the worst flu we can think of, 4%. Go to bird flu, when we've seen the handful of cases of bird flu in humans, that kills more than half of them. So if you put together a highly transmissible disease, influenza, no one's encountered it before, the bird flu, humans don't have antibodies to it, so it will move through the population very quickly, and add to that a high death rate, then you are in real trouble.
The treatments we have for flu, these new treatments like Tamiflu, Relenza, those kinds of things, would they be any help?
They will have a little bit of an effect.
A preventative effect or a treatment effect?
Both. There's a preventative effect in that if you can take the antiviral at the moment that you are at risk of disease, so if you're you're going to come in contact with someone at work, you go on to the antiviral, it will provide protection. We know that. But you have to take it constantly, and the moment you stop it, you've lost your protection. It's not a vaccine. It does have some side effects. They're pretty mild, but there's just not enough of that medication around to give it to enough people to completely control the epidemic. You can't get it out quickly enough. Once you've got disease, the antiviral drugs don't work that well. They do work. For mild disease, they certainly shorten the duration of infection by a couple of days. But it's not nearly as effective as antibiotics would be for pneumonia.
Professor Frank Bowden is my guest in conversation. He's an infectious diseases specialist. He's worked in the front line in the fight against them all of his life. And he's written a book called Gone Viral, The Germs That Share Our Lives. The swine flu outbreak of 2009 you were talking about there wasn't as bad as some people had feared that it might be. People got it though, and it was very unpleasant, and some people died, I think, from it, didn't they?
Yeah. In Australia, and it was very different. It was a very different epidemic. Every year, seasonal flu occurs. Usually it's in autumn. That's the time that people know that it's time for them to have their flu vaccine. And seasonal flu tends to affect the very old and the very young. And we know that. And because people are old and they've got heart disease and diabetes and cancer and other serious illnesses, there it doesn't take much for those people to be tipped over into a serious life-threatening illness with the flu. But that's the general pattern. We vaccinate in Australia a lot of people. The uptake of vaccine is really quite high, and we probably keep the influenza at a relatively controlled level. But the pandemic flu, the swine flu that we saw in 2009, was very different. Now, interestingly, the very old, people greater than 60, 70, let me take that back. I don't mean the very old
okay.
greater than 60.
All right.
I retract that statement. But people who
not
had...
Not quite spring chickens. How's that? Yeah. Okay.
People who were older probably had encountered swine flu in the past. And so when you looked at who was infected and who got sick, it was usually people who were in their teens, 20s, 30s and 40s. And a very important feature was that it was affecting young women and particularly pregnant women. And there were a number of deaths across Australia of both the mother and of the unborn child. And the number of people who needed to go to intensive care in Australia was unprecedented. And the intensive care doctors were really at the front of this. It was fascinating. Most people had a mild illness. A lot of people didn't even know that they'd been infected. Sick for a while. Although a lot of people who really got the flu for the first time felt sick and unwell and said, gosh, this is what the flu is like. This is awful. This is more than just a cold. But then there was the group of very, very sick people who ended up in hospital in the intensive care. And the intensive care group across the country have published this data internationally and have shown that we reached carrying capacity of our intensive care system. Had the swine flu been twice as deadly, twice as virulent, we would have completely overwhelmed our intensive care service. People who, when you get influenza, one of the first serious effects of it for people who end up in hospital is that the lungs become inflamed and you can't breathe and you need high levels of oxygen. So the only way to get that is by putting a tube into the lungs and giving people artificial respiration through that. And you have to increase the amount of oxygen, and oxygen in high levels is dangerous, and it's very, very important to monitor people closely. When you get to a point that they're on the highest level of oxygen they can be, but they still haven't got enough transferring from the lungs into the blood, there's an extreme treatment, which is now available in Australia, but only in certain centres, where you effectively put that person onto bypass. You know, when a person has a coronary artery bypass surgery, you use a heart-lung machine.
For flu?
Yeah, and that, that's for a few hours whilst you do the bypass operation. You take the person off bypass, the heart starts beating, and you go back to it. But for these people, we had from our hospital, and this is all around the country, people were transferred to the centres that could do this. It's called ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, which is a bypass machine. And so you're putting these young people onto a bypass machine and doing it until their lungs recovered. Now, you can only do that so many times before you've run out of machines, and we were at capacity for that.
So the whole swine flu pandemic that came through, that we sort of, at the end of it, I think, there was a kind of a feeling, and obviously maybe I'm quite mistaken, that, oh, that wasn't too bad. Yeah. It really, even that, stretched the hospital system to its absolute limits.
That's right. It didn't stretch the emergency departments too much, because people would come in, it was obvious they were sick, they were moved to the intensive care. It was extremes of illness. It was the very, very sick or the mild illness generally. But had it been twice as bad, we would have overwhelmed the hospital system.
How did you fall in love with infectious diseases, Frank?
Well,
it's a romance, isn't it, really? You have to love it.
Well, it is a romance. You have to love what you do. Medicine's a very hard job. You takes a long time to train, takes a long time to get any good at it, and there's a lot of exams, there's a lot of study, there's a lot of long hours that you have to work to be in.
The responsibility too.
The responsibility weighs upon you constantly. Mm. So it's something that you must love. And I talk to my students all the time about it, that you've got to do something that you love if you're going to sustain it through a lifetime. I fell in love with it, as we most young doctors do, through contact with other people who loved it, and I was taught by a number of wonderful doctors throughout the years. I actually trained at St Vincent's in Melbourne. That's where I did my student training and my basic training to be a physician. But I then moved to Fairfield Hospital in Melbourne, which was the Fairfield Infectious Diseases Hospital, and there in fact, as a student, when I was a student, I met a chap called Alan Jung, who is probably the most inspirational teacher I've ever met. And Alan's love for infectious disease, the creation of the mystery of infectious disease. Every patient has got a little detective story that you have to solve.
So it is like House.
Well, Alan certainly doesn't have House's personality problems, but he certainly has his tenacity and the amazing persistence to get a diagnosis. And Alan would use the Socratic method of teaching. So in the end, he would not teach you too much. You'd teach yourself, but he would take you along a path. And by the end of that, you'd say, oh, how did I get there? And he would be just sitting there smiling as if to say, well, you got yourself there, didn't you?
The pleasure of getting sick people well as well. I mean, when you're treating infectious diseases, sometimes you can really do that. You can actually really turn someone's whole life around and quite quickly at times, Frank.
You can do that at an individual level, which is wonderful. You know, there's nothing better than seeing someone come in who's very, very sick and who comes out well. That's very satisfying. But more satisfying is the fact that infectious diseases usually have a public health dimension to them. And there are things that we can do and recommend at a public health level that can change thousands of lives.
Frank Bowden is my guest in conversation. He's a specialist in infectious diseases. He spent his life looking at germs and what they do to us when they get into our systems. So there you were at the start of your career, Frank, working in the Fairfield Infectious Diseases Hospital, which it's no longer there, is it?
No, Fairfield closed in 96.
So you were around when stories of this mysterious gay plague started coming to the fore. Do you remember that, when before it was actually identified for what it was?
I do. I graduated in 83, so I was a student in 1980 when the first cases were starting to appear. New York and San Francisco doctors were reporting these very strange infections that they normally hadn't seen outside of people who had cancer, who'd been treated with drugs which would reduce their immune system. And they were seeing in people who weren't taking those drugs who were otherwise well. And the groups that they were seeing it in were gay men and also injecting drug users. The infection that they saw was this strange, what we now know is actually a fungal infection of the lungs called PCP or pneumocystis pneumonia. And this illness would be mild to begin with, but over a period of days and then weeks would lead inevitably to what we call respiratory failure.
Is this like out of control thrush, essentially? Is
No. Thrush is different. Thrush is different. No, this. In fact, we thought it was a parasite to begin with, because it doesn't really behave like a fungus. But that's really what it is when you look at it at a molecular level. But this pneumonia would progress to death effectively, and without treatment, people would die. So these young guys, previously well and fit, were coming to hospital and, over a period of several weeks and months, the hospitals in New York and San Francisco were starting to get experience with it and realised how to treat it. But then once they'd treated the pneumonia, they discovered that their immune systems had fallen apart. And they'd fallen apart in a way that had never been seen before. One particular cell within the immune system called it's a T cell, and it's called a T4 cell or a CD4 cell. You'll see those two names around. That particular cell was being depleted and was disappearing from the system. And we know that the CD4 cell is what's known as the conductor of the immune system. By itself, it doesn't do much. It doesn't directly kill cells. It doesn't directly mop up anything.
But it manages it.
Sits in the middle, like a conductor.
Middle management.
Much more important than middle management.
Okay.
Because it's the boss. And without that CD4 cell, the neutrophils wouldn't make a big enough response. They wouldn't go and gobble up the bacteria.
So when did you start seeing patients arrive with this
condition? So in Australia, we saw a couple of patients, well, where I was in Melbourne, a couple of people who'd been overseas were presenting. The first case that we saw at St V's was from a person who ended up in intensive care with a pneumocystis pneumonia. But things really started to accelerate by 1983-84. And I started working in the infectious diseases hospital in 1985. And at that stage, we had 16 people who had what was then known as full-blown AIDS. And we We were sitting there watching, and I'd have to say, you know, and I, looking back on it, I'm almost embarrassed to say this because it was quite fascinating to be part of something very, very new. This is a virus which was unknown to science, causing an illness which we really had never seen before, and no one knew which way things were going to go.
So it was actually exciting. Almost,
so there was a certain excitement. But over time, when we started to watch the inevitable deterioration of what were usually young men, it was usually gay men. There were women involved as well. We must not forget that women, internationally, women are affected as much, if not more, as a proportion than men. But in Australia, this was principally seen in gay men. The inevitable progression to a most awful death was very hard to deal with.
You call this period life during wartime. What does that mean? What do you mean when you say life during wartime? This period.
It's a quote from the Talking Heads song. You know, because this was no party.
This ain't no disco.
This is no fooling around. We were watching something that completely changed our society at the time. Now, young people today will have not been part of what happened then, but at the moment that gay rights were starting to achieve the things that people wanted to achieve, equality, decriminalisation of homosexuality, something which we would find so hard to believe even was a fact back in 1980, that had occurred and people were finding the freedom to live the life they wanted to. And at the moment that that happens, what comes along? But this unknown deadly disease. And it wasn't like they were getting a cancer and you had to sit there with your lover and watch your lover die of a cancer, although many of the diseases that they did get were tumours. It was different. They had an infection, you had the infection too, and you were effectively looking after someone who was your future. And can you imagine what that must have felt for the men and the families sitting there watching this happen? And so for the first 10 years, in fact, it was about 15 years until we got to the point where effective therapy was available, and that's a separate story which you might want to talk about. But for that 15 years, this really was like a war. This was where, Susan Sontag says, don't use military metaphors when you're describing wars on cancer and wars on disease. And I accept that. But this felt like it because people changed their behaviour. People were prepared to do things that they might not otherwise have done. The morality of the society was being shaped by what was going on young people who were dying.
So the very nature of it meant that people had to improvise more and use what they had and speed things up enormously. But the upshot of that, though, is this therapy that's now around that's called HART, I think, HAART, which is the cocktail of eventually. That was the initial one, wasn't it? That's been enormously effective. Did you see that turnaround?
I did. I can remember when I was a young doctor. I can remember talking to my older colleagues, to the people who were teaching me, and I said it must have been wonderful to have been working when penicillin came out. And of course, the people who taught me were too young to know that. They'd never seen the change between penicillin and before penicillin and after penicillin. But can you imagine what it was like if you knew that people with a simple infection, like a Staph aureus boil, would then die from that inevitably? To watch the change. And when you look at the original literature on penicillin treatment, you can see, you know, people were just amazed by what was going on. And I said, oh, wouldn't it be great to live through something like that? And then in 1996, I did. We all did. My generation of doctors lived through a time when, prior to the advent of the combination antiretroviral therapy, you had an inevitable death from HIV, to now, with antiviral therapy, it's become a disease like diabetes. You can't cure it. You can't get rid of the virus. But with daily treatment, and for most people today that means one pill a day, you can completely suppress the virus, people's immune systems reconstitute, they come back to normal, and people live normal lives and probably, And we don't know this yet because it's
early days.
We're going into the future. But from what we can see, people are going to live normal lives. They're going to have a normal lifespan. Now, there are a few things that we have to worry about. People have got to stop smoking. They have to lose weight. They have to exercise. They have to not take drugs. They have to attend to their cholesterol. All those things, they're important because premature aging is a problem of HIV infection and the drugs that people take. But if people are prepared to make those lifestyle changes, then it's likely that their lifespan is going to be normal. That is the single most wonderful change in therapy, in medicine, that we have seen, certainly in my working lifetime.
Before the cocktail came through, I should, before I ask you this question, say that you do give certain... there are stories in your book about patients, but ethically you've been obliged to change names, gender, circumstances, so it's the story that really counts with this. But can you tell the story about one person, particularly before the cocktail arrived, who asked you to euthanize him?
Yeah. And again, this comes back to life during wartime, that during the Second World War, people's morality changed. You know, there was a sense of people, you know, young blokes who were going off to, you know, young Catholic boys going off to war would often be told, well, it's not really a sin to have sex if you know, the chance that you're going to die is so high. You know, people would understand that. People would be influenced by the circumstance. And when you had whole hospitals full of young blokes looking like they had come out of a concentration camp or looking like they were just about to die in a concentration camp, it became reasonably easy for people to countenance the idea that this is really not living, this is just a step before death.
It's life during wartime, the strange ethical choices that come.
Yeah, and so it primed doctors, it primed nurses, it primed the society for a thought that euthanasia here would be very, very reasonable. You know, why would you want to prolong people's lives here? And remembering that euthanasia is the deliberate act of killing, that it's the deliberate act. You say, at this moment, I will now do something which kills you. Not the
turning off the machine.
Turning off the machine. Yeah. Not the stopping of extraordinary treatments, but righto, right now I'll give you an injection which will kill you. And we have no doubt that the HIV epidemic was sort of preparing the society for that. And then in the mid-90s, the euthanasia bill, the rights of the dying bill in the Northern Territory came through, and for a short period of time euthanasia was legalised.
And you were working in the Northern Territory.
And I was working there at the time. And so you had to demonstrate that you had a terminal illness, that the likelihood of you being alive in 12 months was zero, so that you would be dead within 12 months. You had to be clearly not depressed, that you didn't have a psychiatric illness, that you were making this decision clearly with as a competent person. But I was very uncomfortable with this, and I'd actually spoken against the act to the Senate inquiry that had come to the NT at the time, because what I could see was that this wasn't necessarily about end of life. Now, the people who did take up the euthanasia were at the end of their lives. But the way the legislation was written and the way it could occur, someone could get a diagnosis of HIV, they could get PCP, and we knew from the epidemiology at the time that someone with PCP had 18 months to live.
This is this fungal infection.
This is the fungal infection, the pneumonia that they got. Their life expectancy was about 12 to 18 months if you treated them. So you could make a case that that person, therefore, would be eligible for euthanasia, and you could then legally perform euthanasia. I had a letter from this patient who had end-stage HIV infection, was severely immunosuppressed. His immune system was really shot. And he had an infection in his eyes, a viral infection in his eyes called CMV, which causes blindness. And so a very, very terrible way to to die, so that you're dying and you go blind. And the letter said to me, I want you to do euthanasia on me. And it was a terrible dilemma for me. But I wrote back to him, but the thing I should point out is he lived in another state and he wanted to come to the Northern Territory for euthanasia. And if he was to come to the Territory, it would be a terrible wrench away from his family supports, away from friends, and into a very difficult climate. You know, it's a difficult place to live. It's hot and not at that time, not well serviced with palliative care at that time.
But he decided he was prepared to put up with that.
But he said he wanted to do that. But I wrote back and said I could not in conscience do that. And that was a terrible, terrible wrench for me.
And what was your reasoning?
The reasoning was that I thought that he needed to stay where he was and to be treated and to receive palliative care. My feeling was that he with good palliation, and palliation doesn't mean just pain relief. It means dealing with the spiritual, the psychological, the emotional things of death, that would have made it easier for him, and then that would have been actually a better death for him than for someone to travel and to uproot himself from his local area and come to see me.
But was it really about, maybe I'm just guessing here, was it the fact you really couldn't bear to do it?
That's
a huge, huge moral prohibition. You know, prohibition we have in
many,
ourselves.
Many,
don't
we? I don't do this much now because of my practice. But as a younger doctor, on many occasions, I have given people medication to relieve their pain, which I know would shorten their life. I've done that in good conscience, knowing that this is the right thing to do. That the small number of people who are in unbearable pain. And believe me, that's very rare. With good palliative care, you can usually control pain. But in a small group of people who don't wish to lose their consciousness, those people can be in unbearable pain. And I have been involved where you've given it. We call this the double effect. You know, your intent is to relieve pain. It has a secondary consequence which you can't avoid.
Did you hear from that?
No. No, I didn't. I wrote to him with a very, very heavy heart. But I guess the point was that this was at the time that antiretroviral therapy had arrived, and if he went on to antiretroviral therapy, he had a substantially good chance of reconstituting his immune cells and surviving.
My guest today is infectious disease specialist Professor Frank Bowden. His book is called Gone Viral, The Germs That Share Our Lives. A large part of your book is about hygiene, and this is a really interesting story. I mean, there's so many interesting stories about that, and how that's really evolved our whole process of hygiene in the last 150, 160 years. Tell me the amazing story. I've never heard of this guy before. Ignaz Semmelweis. Tell me his story, please.
Semmelweis is very famous amongst infectious disease doctors, and lots of people who are involved in the area sort of feel like Semmelweis. Semmelweis was a Hungarian working in Vienna who, in the 1860s, and he worked in a maternity hospital, and he discovered that there were two streams, if you like, of the maternity hospital. There were the ones where the doctors worked with the medical students, and there was the place for the poor people where the midwives worked. And the doctors would go from the autopsy room straight into the delivery suite. And they would have seen the woman who died that morning from sepsis, you know, from an infection which used to be called childbed fever or puerperal sepsis. They'd see them do the post-mortem and then come straight into the operating theatre, straight into the delivery suite, and then they deliver the baby. Whereas the midwives, who weren't allowed to do the autopsies, would just stay with their patients and deliver their babies. And there was a great difference between the death rate in the doctor side versus the midwife side.
Now, this is the 1860s we're talking
correct,
about?
Correct.
Okay, right.
Correct.
Right.
Semmelweis looked at it and said, as any logical person, there must be something going on here. We've got to think. Perhaps there's something that's being transferred from the post-mortem to the woman. And in those days, the germ theory existed, but people didn't quite understand whether it was a chemical or a toxin or something that was being transferred. People knew transfer occurred, but they didn't know it was living things, bacteria, that were going from one to the other. But what he figured was that let's clean their hands. Let's wash whatever's on their hands off. And he used a solution called slaked lime, which was a hypochlorite solution, like a chlorine solution.
Right.
The doctors hated it because it was quite hard on their hands. But he made them do it. Semmelweis made them do it. And then within 6 months, his infection rate was the same as the midwife's infection rate.
Much improved.
Absolutely. Right. Clear is clear.
All these happy women who are having babies and surviving, what a good result.
Yep.
What could possibly go wrong from here?
Exactly. So Semmelweis published his data and everybody said, you're an idiot. How dare you? How dare you tell us that this could be that it could be the doctors who are doing it? And so his data, which was irrefutable, was ignored. And the people and
seriously, like doctors are putting their hands in corpses, then going and delivering babies. The women are clearly dying. It's there in the evidence. And the doctors say, well, there can't possibly be a relationship here.
And it was to do with authority. That Semmelweis certainly wasn't a subtle person, and he, you know, wrote letters that accused people who didn't take any notice of him of being murderers and killers and things.
And so how did it go wrong for him after that?
Well, unfortunately, it's unknown whether he had syphilis or not, but he may have had a syphilitic infection of his brain which made him crazy, and he ended up in an asylum.
How did they get him in the asylum?
They had to arrest him. So they came around and tricked him, and they said, come on, we'll show you. We want you to come and inspect a place. And he went with them, and then the guards captured him and put him in the asylum. And interestingly, as he was beaten by the guards, and he developed an infection of his leg, and he probably died from the germ that he was working on all his life. But it wasn't – the amazing thing was that this information, which was so clear, so simple – wasn't taken up by people until another 30 or 40 years.
The guy who found the link between essentially hand washing, really, and the absence of it and infection, then is arrested, put into an insane asylum, and dies of an infection. I mean, they've got to make a movie about that guy, don't they? I mean, that's extraordinary. What a story.
Yeah, there have been movies. There's some movie, black and white movies from the 40s, I think.
You write in your book about the hand-washing regimes, and you've seen, you know, every once in a while there's a story in the media where it's revealed that a hospital has been imperfect in its following of the hand-washing policy, and this comes up, and things have happened as a result of that. Why do you think hospitals set these policies on hand-washing and then don't follow them? Why does that happen?
Yeah, this is very interesting. I mean, the if you look at it in Australia, we've got a very effective campaign, which is now funded by the federal government, rolled out across the country, which is the Hand Hygiene Initiative. And people now have people working in every hospital to make sure that hand hygiene is promoted. 10 years ago, you wouldn't have seen alcohol hand rub, which is these little bottles of often a pink solution that people go around and rub.
But their hands. Why is all this necessary? Why is it? I mean, doctors must know, and nurses know this, don't they? I mean, so why is it necessary?
Well, one of the themes of my book is that we've forgotten about infection, that there's a moral hazard associated with our treatments, that because we've got antibiotics, people say, that's all right, infections are okay, they're under control. We can deal with them with antibiotics, don't worry about it. But what, again, I think that we failed, you know, as an infectious disease doctor, I think I failed to convey to people how important infection is. Prevention is, you know, okay, here's the cliche, prevention's better than cure. And you say it so many times you think it doesn't mean anything. By gosh, it does. If you get a bloodstream infection, if you get Staphylococcus in your blood, that happens in our hospital once a week, and then mainly from people who come from the community. So there's not much we can do about it. You know, these are people who are otherwise fit and well, who develop, you know, a cut on their leg, the staph gets into their blood, and they come in really sick. That person has a, depending on their age, but on average, that person has a 20% chance of being dead in a year. 20%. If they had a heart attack that day, they'd have a 7% chance of being dead.
There's a story, a really shocking story in your book, about a patient admitted after he'd been punched in the face by a drunk and fell over in the gutter by mistake. You know, the drunk was aiming for the other guy and hit this guy instead. He fell over. His face got cut by broken glass in the gutter. Tell me what happened to him after he was admitted to hospital.
Well, this poor guy ended up with an infection in his blood, a staph infection in his blood, which had been caused by the cannula, the little drip that had been put into his arm. And it was a simple little thing, tiny piece of plastic sitting in his arm. And because it hadn't been removed, as it should have been, when he arrived in the hospital and a clean one put in, the infection was able to get in through that piece of plastic and into his bloodstream, and he died. Now, I've highlighted an uncommon case. I mean, that's a rare case. The vast majority of people will not get that complication. But, you know, the weight of a death of a young person is such that if there's something simple that we can do as doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals, something like looking at the cannulas that we put into people and changing them regularly and following what every hospital has, which is a policy about its intravenous cannulas, by doing that, you might do that 100 times and not save a life. But on the 100th time, when you do save the life, that's a pretty important thing. But it's prevention. No one thanks you when you prevent something. They thank you. They thank you when they've got out of the intensive care and say, thank you, doctor. But when you've prevented something, they didn't even know you did it. And so this is the thing that we have to embed in our teaching, in our culture for students.
Frank, just finally, I see lots of ads on TV for antiseptic wipes in kitchens, and the implication is bad mother if you don't douse your house in disinfectant, essentially. What's your thought on that? There is sometimes said that kids are cosseted because they're not exposed to normal day-to-day germs these days.
Yeah, having focused on germs and saying to people, you've got to be absolutely meticulous, that's for doctors and nurses in healthcare settings. In the domestic situation, these kind of antibacterial products are usually just a waste of time. Soap and water, normal cleanliness, washing things, you know, hot soap and water and detergent is the most important thing you can do. You know, good preparation of your meat so you don't keep your chicken, your uncooked chicken next to your cooked chicken, things like that. Far more important than antibacterial wipes. And what's likely to happen is that we'll generate resistance by doing that.
Okay, so it is good to be exposed to day-to-day germs then.
Our children need to be exposed to germs as long as it's the right germs.
Gee, it's amazing talking to you, Frank. You know, there's so much more on this we didn't even get to talk about today because it's all so absorbing. I've got to get you back on to talk about some more of these cases you've observed in your time. It's been lovely speaking with you. Thank you so much for being my guest today in Conversation.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.